From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 281 with guest Glenn Barry. Recorded Sunday, September 9th, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Hey, if you haven't already heard, we're back on the road again. That's right. Carl Franklin and I are doing a 3-podcast road trip. So that's .NET Rocks, Run As Radio, and The Tablet Show. We're traveling across the U.S. We're doing 35 cities, including 2 in Canada. And you can learn more about that road trip at .NETRocks.com/roadtrip. And I hope you'll come out and see us. We're talking a little DevOps. We're going to be talking about some of the stuff coming in Windows 8. Going to be some great swag given away and lots of fun had. So .NETRocks.com/roadtrip for your information on the road trip. That's not what we're going to talk about now. We're going to talk about SQL hardware. My guest today is Glenn Barry, and Glenn is a principal consultant with SQL Skills. He has worked as a SQL Server professional for many years in a variety of roles, most recently as a database architect for Avalara in Parker, Colorado. Glenn has been a SQL Server MVP since 2007, and he has a whole collection of Microsoft certificates, including an MCITP, an MCDBA, MCSE, MCSD, MCAD, and MCTS, which I think is pretty much all of them. Don't you say bingo at some point here? Which proves that he likes to take tests, and apparently is good at them, too. His expertise includes DMVs, high availability, hardware selection and configuration, and performance tuning. He's also an adjunct faculty member at University College, the University of Denver, where he's been teaching since 2000. He's completed a master teaching program at Denver University. He's heavily involved with the SQL Server community and a frequent speaker at User Group, SQL Saturdays, and the PaaS Community Summit. He's also the author of SQL Server Hardware, and he wrote chapters for the SQL Server MVP Deep Dives and SQL Server MVP Deep Dives Volume 2 books. Welcome, Glenn.
Well, thanks a lot for that welcome. I appreciate it.
You bet. And you and I are going to geek out on hardware because I'm a hardware guy, you're a hardware guy, and there's a lot to talk about with hardware around SQL Server.
Yeah, there is, especially with the licensing changes for SQL Server 2012. A lot of people are more interested in hardware than they were on previous versions of SQL Servers.
Okay, so for those who haven't looked yet, what's the big deal with the 2012 licensing?
Well, what happened is back in November of 2011, Microsoft announced that they were moving to core-based licensing for SQL Server 2012 Enterprise Edition. Previously, it was done by the physical socket, so you could have as many cores as you wanted and you didn't pay any extra. So it was sort of a free ride for a long time, but now that's changed.
Yeah, so that's why we always went for 4 and 8 core per socket machines, because it just was cheaper that way.
Yeah, you know, having lots of cores per socket didn't cost you any extra, so you can get a 16-core AMD-based processor, and that was sort of a decent way to go previously, but not so much anymore.
And the enterprise license was $25,000 a socket?
Exactly, and now it's roughly $6,800 per core, and you have to get a minimum of 4 cores per socket for the license.
So the sort of 4 minimum puts us right at the $25,000 right there, but a 16 is almost $100,000.
Yeah, exactly. So if you stay with a quad core, the pricing is the same, but if you go to higher core counts, it can be quite a bit more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and my first thought is, I better make sure I'm using those cores.
Yeah, there is that. You know, it's still pretty affordable compared to Oracle licensing.
Well, I've always felt like the Oracle licensing model was, so how much money you got?
Yeah, pretty much.
I've never had a salesperson ask me for my financial statements before. And I'm like, really? I think I'm going to give you those. Thanks very much for asking.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and compared to Oracle, Microsoft's still pretty affordable, but now you've got to be a little more careful about how you select your hardware. And you need to pay attention to how well different processors perform with different workload types. So that's really important to pay attention to now.
Yeah, certainly that's something nobody's ever thought about. I think we generally just over-provision SQL Server.
Well, some people do that, and some people just make poor choices. You know, they think about, you have system admin type people who go out and spec out your servers and provision them, and they don't really know how SQL Server uses the hardware. And a lot of DBAs don't know very much about hardware, so you have a problem there.
Right. And it's only impacted by cores. We can throw as much memory as we want, right?
Well, to an extent. With SQL Server Standard Edition, you're still limited to 64 gigs of RAM, which is fairly low with modern hardware.
Sure. And by enterprise, it's like the roof's the limit now. What are we putting into some of these machines? Over a terabyte of RAM.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. With Windows Server 2012, along with SQL Server 2012, you can go up to 4 terabytes of RAM, and you can get that in an 8-socket server, you know, pretty easily now.
Wow. Well, I remember when that was a big SAN.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing how much RAM. And RAM is just almost criminally inexpensive now. It's down to about $15 a gigabyte.
Yeah.
So it really kills me when I see people go out and buy brand new servers and they're thinking about putting 16 gigs or 32 gigs of RAM, and I've got 32 gigs of RAM on my laptop.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's crazy cheap. I've never seen memory as cheap as it is right now. Well, storage as a whole has gotten crazy cheap too.
It has, you know, storage, even with flash-based storage, is not nearly as fast as memory, and mm-hmm. having lots of memory is sort of a cheap substitute for storage, especially for read.
Yeah.
So going high on RAM is really never a mistake.
So given a choice between spending money on SSDs and spending money on more RAM for SQL Server, you'll take the RAM.
Well, I'll take the RAM first because, you know, spending $2,000 or $3,000 on RAM will probably let you have your whole database in memory for a lot of people, and then if you need more after that, then you start looking at flash-based storage.
Sure. So you described early on here this idea that different workloads utilize hardware differently. Can you elaborate on that? What does that really look like?
Well, sure. Well, you know, kind of the classic way of looking at workloads from a database engine perspective is you've got OLTP-type workloads on one end of the spectrum with lots of short transactions and a pretty high percentage of write activity. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have more of a data warehouse type of workload with very few writes and longer running queries that often are parallelized by the query processor.
Mm-hmm. Big aggregate queries.
Exactly. So looking at your workload type, you usually don't have a pure OLTP or pure data warehouse. It can be a mix. But looking at the workload type for your environment is really important when you're looking at what processors to choose, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And a good example of that is Intel processors tend to do extremely well on OLTP workloads because they have better single-threaded performance compared to the AMD processors.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you can see this if you look at the TPCe benchmark scores. And what I like to do to try to make this make more sense is you take the raw TPCe score and divide it by the number of cores in the database server that they use for the test. And that gives you a score per core. And then that helps you sort of compare different processors to figure out which one's really the best one. Because a lot of people have this idea that bigger servers are faster than smaller servers, and that's not really the case with how Intel does their processor release cycle.
Interesting. I mean, because when we think about what Intel's largely been working on the processor side of things, they've been really pushing on these, you know, the Ivy Bridge infrastructure, these sorts of things that are really about low power, high efficiency processing. But when we want the muscle of high transactional volume, that's a different processor.
Exactly. I mean, AMD sort of made a choice to go to higher core counts because mm-hmm. they really couldn't compete with Intel on single-threaded performance. And AMD processors are less expensive than Intel processors, but when you look at the SQL Server license cost, it's usually not a big factor in the overall cost of the server.
Right. Because the price of hardware itself is crazy cheap. As soon as you start to talk about looking at the difference in behavior between OLTP and, say, OLAP, I'm prone to buying two separate machines here then.
That's one thing that I talk about in my book and also in a lot of my presentations. A lot of people have this idea that when you get a database server, you want a single 4-socket machine, for example.
Right.
But I argue you're better off with two 2-socket machines. If you can split your workload, you're going to get much more capacity and much better performance, actually spend less money if you go that way.
Although, outside of the licensing costs, hardware just doesn't seem to be that expensive.
Yeah, it isn't. I mean, you can spend a lot more on your license costs than you do on the hardware.
Sure.
But My argument is that choosing the right hardware can minimize your license costs to the point where your hardware is basically free outside of the storage subsystem.
So how radically different are we talking about when you compare AMD doing a big aggregate workload to an Intel doing OLTP?
Well, you know, since AMD has more physical cores, they tend to do better, relatively speaking, on data warehouse type workloads. But even so, if it was my choice, I would probably still lean towards an Intel solution because, you know, the Intel processor that has the highest core count right now has 10 physical cores.
Right.
Or you can get AMD with 12 or 16 physical cores. And if you look at their benchmark scores, those extra cores just aren't justified, and you're paying so much money for them now with core-based licensing. So as much as I hate to say it, you know, I really can't make a good argument for buying an AMD processor for anything for SQL Server. I mean, it's great for virtualization hosts, for example.
Right.
You're running lots of workstations or web servers that are virtualized, but for SQL Server, it really just doesn't make sense anymore.
That's interesting. I'm sure there's going to be a conspiracy theory out there that says this whole thing was done to hurt AMD.
Yeah, the, you know, the AMD zealots might think that. And, of course, Microsoft came out with the core factor table on April 1st of this year, which is an unfortunate date.
That is unfortunate.
But they actually, you know, give a little bit of a licensing discount for the modern AMD processors. They let you multiply your physical cores times 0.75.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps out a little bit. But still, if you do the math, you know, looking at a 16-core AMD processor, they performs about as well as a 6-core Intel processor. There's no way that you can justify that, pay all that extra license cost.
But is that in single-threaded performance, or is that going to be a multi-threaded performance? Like, I'm thinking about a great big multi-join aggregate query, which is just going to lend itself some good parallelism.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm thinking more single-threaded performance, but if you actually look at some of the TPC-H benchmark scores, AMD doesn't do that well there. They do a little bit better, relatively speaking, but Intel is doing so much better on these benchmarks and in real life, in my experience.
And I mean, what are we really attributing this to? Is it just that they're a couple of generations ahead in their fabrication and approach to building CPUs that they can get such good single-core, single-thread performance?
Well, I think that's a lot of them. If you look at the market share, Intel has such a dominant market share, and they own their own fabs.
Right.
They're, you know, 12 to 18 months ahead of AMD on process technology, and all those things tend to add up.
Yeah. Well, they're ahead of everybody on everything in that respect. I mean, just they're making the finest, smallest nanometer circuits out there right now.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're already down to 22 nanometers, and 14 nanometers coming early next year with Haswell.
Which means that fab is under construction right now.
Exactly. You know, Intel's pouring billions of dollars into fab construction all the time. So, you know, and I hate to see this happening, because if Intel doesn't have any viable competition, I'm afraid they're going to slow down. And why should they push the envelope?
Well, sure. But, you know, see the whole P4 lost decade.
Exactly.
You know,
I remember that very well.
And that was pure hubris on Intel's part. They went the wrong direction and had to go back, and AMD got a chance to catch up and do, I think, some really important things. The whole X64 instruction set comes out of that.
No, you're right. That's exactly true. And that's why a lot of people remember that, and they still think that AMD is doing well technically, and that hasn't been the case for about 4 years now.
That's tough, yeah. Not that I hate Intel. If I look around this room, almost every machine is an Intel-based machine. But these are the people who brought you Itanium.
Yeah.
And
you're right about that.
Yeah. That when they didn't have that pressure, they went off and did their own things, whether we wanted them to or not. And when they did have that pressure, they did stuff that genuinely made processing better.
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, the important thing to look at right now is which Intel processor you get for the database server.
So what are you paying attention to?
Yeah, I pay a lot of attention to that. But, you know, the one that I recommend for a lot of people is the Sandy Bridge EP, which is the E5 2600 series. That's really the best processor out there right now for especially OLTP workloads.
And those are coming in, those are 8-core chips these days?
Yeah, those are 8-core, plus you have hyper-threading on top of that. But you can also get lower core count versions of that if you're concerned about licensing.
Right. Do the hyper-thread cores count?
No, they don't. Only physical cores count
for
SQL Server licensing.
And for those who remember HyperCore or hyperthreading from the P4 days, this is not the same brain damage behavior.
No, it isn't. That's another thing. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, it used to be when the initial implementation came out with the NetBurst architecture, it worked well on the desktop, but for SQL Server, sometimes it actually hurt performance.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember.
And you see a lot of blog posts and white papers that just say, oh, turn off hyperthreading.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mistake. You really ought to test it with your workload. But with these newer processors, they have a different architecture. They don't have that deep pipeline like the NetBurst architecture did. So a cache miss is not as expensive as it used to be. Plus, the L2 and L3 caches are much bigger and faster, and access to main memory is faster. So because of that, hyperthreading is usually a win, especially with OLTP workloads.
Interesting. So, I mean, because you'd think with OLTP, this is a single-threaded behavior. Really, we just want the primary path through the core. But hyperthreading still comes into play there?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's interesting that every single TPCe benchmark that's been submitted for an Intel processor has had hyperthreading enabled.
And they're typically these Sandy Bridge EPs?
Well, yeah, Sandy Bridge EP, but even earlier, you know, like Nehalem and Westmere processors that have hyperthreading, it's all been enabled for all of those. So really, in the Halo and above, it definitely improves performance for most workloads.
As long as it's a transactional workload.
Right. Where it might hurt you occasionally is on a data warehouse type workload where you've got a highly parallelized query and parts of it will finish ahead of other parts of it since it's hyper-threaded.
Right.
That can actually hurt performance in some cases. So you really should test it on your workload.
You get a big synchronization block when that happens?
I think that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard Connor Cunningham talk about what the query processor is doing with that. And generally speaking, especially if you are seeing a lot of, you know, max stop one type queries, hyperthreading is definitely going to help you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me as well. I've always struggled with SQL Server doing a good job in big parallel executes. It's one of those things I think consistently demos well. You can always construct a query that it can parallelize well, but in the field, I've banged in it time and time again where we've had trouble with multi-threading.
Yeah, but it seems like each major version of SQL Server gets better with that.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of people have this idea that if they're seeing CX packet weights, they want to go in and change max stop to one, and that's a mistake most of the time. You really don't want to just do that.
Yeah.
Let SQL Server have a chance to parallelize those queries.
Yeah, there's no absolutes here, right? Like this really comes down to your workload.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you test a workload? What are you doing when you really want to benchmark different hardware?
Well, you know, I don't have a lab, unfortunately, that I can, you know, test a lot of hardware myself anymore as a consultant.
But sure.
I look really hard at the TPCe benchmark scores, and I also like to run this cross-platform benchmark called Geekbench. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No, tell me about it.
Well, it's more famous in the Mac world, but it is truly cross-platform, runs on Linux and Windows, and what it does is it exercises your CPU and memory subsystem. It takes about 3 minutes to run, and it gives you a score that's broken down by CPU and memory with about 15 or 20 different subscores.
This sounds like an agnostic Windows experience score.
It is similar to that.
Yeah.
You know? And what I use it for is that you can run it on an existing server that you have and servers you have in a lab, and then you can look. There's an online database where other people can run it and submit their scores.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that to help compare different processors and different servers from a memory and CPU perspective. And I use that to kind of help adjust TPCe scores because hardware vendors only test their top bin processors for TPCe since it's so expensive.
Sure.
And if you're thinking about getting a more of a mid-range processor, for example, which I don't think is a good idea for SQL Server, but if you're going along that route, you can use these Geekbench scores to help figure out how far to adjust your score up or down when you're comparing two different systems.
Mm-hmm. So the big thing here is getting a feel for compare the high-end system with Geekbench to your mid-tier system. That percentage difference is probably going to be reflected in the TPCe score too.
Right. They seem to correlate pretty closely because TPCe, if you have decent I.O. behind it, not crazy I.O. like TPCC, but
right,
just decent I.O., it's going to be CPU limited.
Yeah, which is, you know, that was my next question, Glenn, which is, when did we get CPU limited in SQL Server? I thought we were always I.O. limited.
Well, ideally, you would be CPU limited. You know, a lot of people are I/O limited because, you know, they out and buy a decent server and a decent amount of RAM, and they try to run it on 6 internal drives.
Right.
And then they have I/O bottlenecks. I see that all the time. You know, it's like a guy who goes into the gym and only works out his upper body, and he looks like a chicken because he never does any leg work.
Right.
So, you know, but people who know what they're doing and get a decent amount of memory and a decent I/O subsystem can become CPU bound.
Mm-hmm.
When you get rid of all the other bottlenecks, the final bottleneck is CPU. And my argument also is, even if you aren't CPU limited now, you should over-provision your CPUs, because then you can take advantage of things like data compression and backup compression and use up that CPU to relieve your I/O subsystem and memory subsystem of some of the pressure.
Sure. Well, as long as, so, and again, if you're paying per core, it's important to make those individual cores as fast as possible. That's going to be a better return for you than buying more slower cores.
Yeah, exactly, especially if you have more of an overall CPU workload, because your single-threaded performance is directly related then.
Right. Well, yeah, I think it seems to me now with this new pricing model, it's the fewest, fastest cores you can lay your hands on is going to be the most cost-effective solution.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I recommend people who are really concerned about this licensing cost, and you know, for a lot of bigger companies, it's not a big deal, but for some companies, it is a big deal. And so, for example, you can go out and get a Xeon E5-2643, which only has 4 cores, but it has a higher base clock speed of 3.3 gigahertz
right,
compared to the top-of-the-line 2690. That's going to give you a little bit better single-threaded performance. Of course, you do give up a little bit of scalability and capacity there, but you save 50% on your licensing cost.
Sure. And it doesn't make any difference if you get a 2-socket or a 4-socket, because it's just the total number of cores that matter anyway.
Yeah, to a certain extent, although one thing I wanted to talk about is the way Intel releases their processors, mm-hmm. they sort of have two different markets. They have the 2-socket market and then the 4-socket and above market. And the 4-socket and above is generally a generation behind the 2-socket
interesting
market. And so the E5 2600 series is only available for 2-socket servers.
Why?
Most people.
Why?
Well, why would they do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. You have to ask Intel, but my theory is that the sales volume is a lot higher in the 2-socket space. A lot
right.
of people buy web servers and app servers compared to 4-socket servers.
Sure.
So anyways, because of that, there's about a 12 to 18 month delay before the next generation Intel releases show up in the 4-socket space. So right now, the best you can get in the 4-socket space traditionally was the Westmere EX. And that's one release behind Sandy Bridge.
Right.
And Sandy Bridge is available in the 2-socket space. And they actually recently came out with a 4-socket version of that called the 4600 series that will go into 4-socket servers. And that's actually faster than the E7 series that's been around for about a year now.
And again, we get back to this idea of, because the hardware is relatively cheap compared to the licensing costs, I'd probably be better off with, even if it's just OLTP workloads, buy 2 2-core with the latest stuff in it.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then just split my workloads up.
Yep. I totally believe that's the best way to go.
Hmm.
And I also tell people all the time that don't ever let anybody like your CTO talk you into reusing your old 3 or 4 year old server for SQL Server 2012. Because you're going to get relatively bad performance and pay a lot more for licensing costs than you need to.
Sure.
These new 2-socket servers with E5-2690s in them, they can handle really big workloads, and they actually have higher TPCe scores than the 4-socket servers from 2 or 3 years ago.
Nice.
Significantly higher.
And that's so, what's actually going to matter to you long-term here. Not that you shouldn't repurpose a server, but maybe IIS would be a better workload.
Yeah, or maybe you take that production server from 2 or 3 years ago and make it a dev or QA server.
Yeah.
But don't try to reuse it just because you don't want to spend $10,000 or $15,000 on a new server. That's false economy.
Actually. Sure. You're going to spend more than that on a couple of enterprise licenses.
Exactly.
Yeah, it really has shifted the math around to, as much as it's more expensive, it seems fairer. Like we're going to be using the hardware better because of it.
Yeah, you can make that argument, but I get people complaining to me almost daily on my blog about why did Microsoft change this,
right.
and that's going to mean they're going to skip 2012, and yeah, well, it wasn't my decision. You have to use your head to try to minimize the cost and take advantage of what you can.
Well, and therein lies the next question, which is, do we really want to upgrade to 2012? Like, what are we getting in 2012 besides this new licensing model that makes it worthwhile?
Well, you know, there's a few compelling features for 2012. You know, I don't want to sound like a Microsoft salesperson exactly, but,
yep.
You know, column store indexes are interesting, especially when they become writable, hopefully fairly soon. And another one that's interesting for a lot of people is always-on availability groups. You know, that's much better than clustering or mirroring for high availability and disaster recovery. So those are probably the two most important features. There's a lot of other small features, enhancements to GSQL, for example, but those are the two big ones in my book.
But I do think it's an effort on the part of IT folks now looking at this new version to say, we really need to rethink our hardware allocation and know our workloads better to justify this cost. Just dropping the new version on the existing hardware seems like the worst thing you could do.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and a classic example of that is a lot of people had these old 6-core Intel processors. They were the Xeon X7460s.
Right.
Or the Dunnington. They don't have hyper-threading, and they were the hot ticket that was a top-of-the-line processor about 3 years ago, and there's a lot of those out there now. Well, that's a terrible machine to run Server 2012 on.
Right, you got that hardware with 2008.
Yeah,
and exactly. These were the hot rig then.
Mm-hmm. But it turns out that thing has a Geekbench score of about 15,000, just to give you an idea,
mm-hmm.
and a brand-new 2-socket. E5 2690 has a Geekbench score of about 40,000.
Holy man.
And so you're looking at 4 sockets times 6, so you have 24 cores versus a brand new 2-socket 2690 would be 16 cores. So you're a huge difference in licensing costs and only about 1/3 the performance. But I see people doing that all the time. You know, oh, this server's still under warranty. You should just put 2012 on it. And that's a big mistake.
Sure. Well, and you're talking about $10,000 to $20,000 worth of hardware. Like it's just not that much money compared to the licensing costs.
Right.
I'm wondering how the VLAs, the volume license agreements, are going to impact that licensing cost for the bigger customers.
Well, you know, my understanding is that there's some grandfathering going on, so people who have bought existing SA agreements, you know, can grandfather into 2012 and convert over their cores into the new ones. And in some cases, you know, get the upgrade for free depending on what they did.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, that's something you'd have to negotiate with your rep and see what kind of a deal you can get on that. I think you can probably get a good deal right now as you're trying to get SQL Server 2012 moving.
Sure. And there's an interesting point here about how much has 2012 adoption been hurt by this new licensing strategy.
Right. Yeah, I have no idea. You know, I think Microsoft's spending a lot of time on SQL Azure right now.
Sure. Yeah, and the whole other side of this is, are we seeing what new licensing is going to look like going forward now?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they seem like they change fairly often on how they want to handle that. But people just got used to the old socket-based licensing, and it's hard to change to this new world.
The core-based. But, you know, when they came up with socket-based, we were just getting into multi-core. It's only been a few years. And, you know, the multi-core machines really started rolling out in the early 2000s. And so it made a lot of sense for them to say, oh, we'll just go socket-based because nobody really knows and we don't want to impair that progress. You know, let's go that way. But now that we know that multi-core is here to stay, you know, this is a somewhat more honest licensing model and it might propagate across all of the products.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of vendors have been doing that for years. Microsoft is sort of late to the game there. So
sure.
I think most people think it was sort of inevitable what was going to happen.
And on the other hand, it's like, I can skip 2012 because by 2014, they'll have changed their minds. I'll never had to pay this bigger fee.
Yeah, exactly.
And we don't know which way that's actually going to land. I mean, it's an interesting debate. On the other hand, I appreciate this sentiment in general of, let's make sure we're using our gear well.
Yeah, well, you always have that tension. Your CTO wants your CPUs running at 100% and the DBA wants it to run at 10%.
Right.
And there's a lot of underutilized servers out there, you know, hence the big push to virtualization, for example.
Yeah, that does beg an interesting question, how this licensing model looks like under virtualization, which I don't know. Where do you fall on the virtualizing of SQL Server world?
Well, I used to be pretty much against it, mm-hmm. but now the amount of overhead is pretty low. You've got to keep in mind that the laws of physics don't change with virtualization. You've got to have enough resources, you know, on your virtual host to run the workload properly.
And you have complicated things by creating a layer of virtualization in there.
Yeah, you have, you know, because then there's more people with their fingers in the pie and you can point fingers in different directions. But if you've got your hypervisor set up correctly, SQL Server set up correctly, it'll run, you know, with the exception of just mission critical tier one workloads, I have no problem running virtualized.
Sure. And with all of the advantage that comes in there, but is it the virtual cores then that you're licensing for an enterprise edition?
I believe so, but you know, I'm not exactly 100% sure about how they handle virtualized licensing for SQL Server. It's a little bit different. I think you actually have to count the virtualized cores. And of course, one nice thing is Windows Server 2012, Hyper-V has much higher limits for how many virtual CPUs you can have. You can have four virtual CPUs in a virtualized machine now, or that limit used to be a lot lower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they bumped all those numbers up. But if they talk about switching over to licensing on Hyper-V as well, that's going to again get everyone back looking at provisioning rules.
Yeah. No, you're right.
I'll tell you the other thing that I've run into over and over again, people just installing the Enterprise Edition and not using its features. They only needed the Standard Edition. This kind of pricing strategy makes it very clear you better need Enterprise.
That's true. Although speaking as an actual DBA, you want Enterprise because it makes your life so much easier with things like online index operations, for example,
mm-hmm.
and data compression that are actually very useful. And I really push for Enterprise Edition, but you know, I can understand how much more money it is. And
sure.
You're right. Some people, if they just install Enterprise because they don't know any better, they're going to have to think twice about it now if they have high core counts.
Well, and I think most people hit the memory limitation and just go, okay, well, I need Enterprise. 64 gigs is not going to do.
Yeah. Of course, what a lot of people forget about is on Server Standard Edition, there's a 32 gigabyte limit.
Okay.
That trips up people sometimes also at the OS level.
Yeah. So you're already up against it anyway. But again, you get back to this idea of maybe I'm better off getting three or four standard machines and splitting up these databases amongst them rather than just managing one tank when you start doing these license calculations.
Yeah, you know, and even before all these new licensing things, you still could make that argument because Windows machines don't scale in a linear fashion. So
right.
A four-socket box is not twice as good as two-socket boxes or a single-socket box.
Sure. Absolutely true. Well, sir, I appreciate your insights here. It makes me really think hard about hardware again. I've been ignoring it for a while because it was inexpensive and the licensing wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, well, you just need to think about it as you're getting ready to provision a new server because otherwise you're going to be stuck with it for two or three or four years. So.
Awesome. And where can we see you next?
Well, I'll be speaking at the PATH Summit in Seattle in November.
Right.
And I'm going to be a couple SQL Saturdays before that. One here in Denver, and then I'll be going, I can't remember, to be honest. I got quite a few. I blog about it, actually, in my speak schedule.
Great. I'll make sure we get a link to your blog on the website so people can find you.
Sounds good.
Glenn Berry, thanks so much for talking to us.
All right, thanks.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.